Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. As I said earlier, this is the first talk that I've given here since the end of the rains retreat. During the 3 months of the rains retreat, we don't come down to the city centre, but we stay in the monastery and practice there. But I wouldn't like you to think that we don't do things, that things don't happen in the monastery, even though it's the rains retreat. Also, I can see a few old familiar faces who have I haven't seen for a long time, who have been around helping at the monastery in the past. So just to let you know that we do get up to things in the monastery even during the rains retreat, and for those of you who may have been out of touch with what's been going on there, I'll just let you know of some of the changes that happened in the 3 months. Our community has now grown to 6 with we had 3 new trainees come especially for the rains, and 2 of those women have decided to stay on and continue the training. So together with myself and 2 other nuns and 1 other Anagarika who was already in residence, we now have another 2, so that means that the community is now 6. That's very nice news. And also, before the rains retreat started, we were in the process of building 3 more kutis, and that work was continued in the first part of the rains. So now we've completed that work, so we have 3 new kutis, so altogether 5 kutis there now. And we also were engaged in upgrading our water storage and catchment facilities. So we have another new large storage tank, and we also have a solar pump at our 3rd dam, which may seem very boring and mundane to most of you, but anyone who lives in an area where there isn't town water can appreciate that to have ample water is a great blessing. And in the monastery up until now, we've always been relying on rainwater, and so sometimes we've been very short on water, but now we have the addition of the dam water for use in our building, so it's made a great difference to our use of the water and our ease of getting things done. And particularly with the new pump and the new tank, we've now been able to irrigate some of the areas that we've been trying to revegetate. We've been trying to revegetate them for the last 5 years with great difficulty, because we've had to hand water and carry the water from the dams, and now we've got an irrigation system, which is wonderful. So these are quite significant changes for those of us who live in the monastery, and also those who come to visit, and also for those of you who've been involved with the monastery from early days, to see it grow and be ever more well established. And when we experience change like this, the growth and development is definitely a change. And when we contemplate change, we see that even the happiest changes bring two aspects with them. They bring the enjoyment of the benefits, but there's always some downside. There's always something that comes along with the positives of change. So, for example, now we have more people in the monastery and more people to do the work, more people to be involved in development, but there are more people to look after if you're the person in charge. There are more mouths to feed, and all parents would know what that's like, trying to look after all the kids, not just one or two. And of course we're very well supported in Perth with ample requisites, but it still means that there are more things in the mind of the person in charge because there are more people. And this is just the nature of anything that comes into our life. Even the happiest events bring with them the other aspect of things. And often we are challenged by the change that comes. Often it brings with it unexpected aspects, things which we hadn't expected or which we hadn't thought through. And what appeared to be a wonderful new thing, a wonderful development, turns out to be something that is more or less than we bargained for. And so we experience a different reaction to change. Very often, because change does bring with it more than we expected, we fear change. And so we do everything we can to maintain our situation in a static state, to keep it the way it is now, because at least with familiarity we know what we've got. We get familiar with it. We feel like we've got it under our control. And this attempt to control situations and the fear that they're going to get out of our control is one of the aspects of our life as human beings that we need to wake up to. Because in reality, it's impossible to control our situations completely, no matter how skillful or clever or wise or rich we are. That's the nature of reality. And if we don't understand that deeply, if we don't acknowledge that consciously, then our fears can drive us. Our fears can become what defines our life. Our attempts to keep things as they are and to maintain control means that we don't allow ourselves to grow. So I'd like to talk about the way that we challenge our fears and the way we need to work with them if we're going to live fully and make the most of this wonderful human life. I came to contemplate this topic recently because of the fact that spring is in the air and spring is in the monastery. And this is one of the changes that happens naturally, comes around every year, whether we like it or not. And it always brings with it both positive and negative. If you live in the bush, then it's wonderful because the wildflowers are out. But it also brings with it the recognition that the bushfire season is just around the corner. Can't have one without the other. It also means that a lot of the creatures that live in the bush have reproduced, and their babies are just getting ready to fly the coop. And recently I've been watching the birds as they get ready to leave their nests. And I've seen firsthand how the birds need to overcome their fears if they're going to survive. We have lots of magpies at the monastery, as you probably have in lots of your gardens. And you may not know that magpies live in groups, not just in single families, and that the older generation, the previous generation, looks after the next generation, feeds them, teaches them, prepares them to be adults. And it's quite interesting to watch how the group of magpies try to bring up the next generation, try to get these young birds to leave the nest and do what they need to do to survive. The magpie baby, when it's ready to fly, sits in the tree and squawks and squawks and squawks and squawks and squawks, makes a big fuss. It's time, but it's not sure whether it's really ready. And the other magpies, the adults, fly away from the baby and also make a noise. Come on, give it a go. And the baby squawks and squawks and squawks and squawks and squawks. And when they're first starting off, they can squawk for 20 minutes or half an hour before they're willing to fly down from the tree. And as soon as they fly down from the tree, one of the adult magpies flies in and puts a bit of food in its mouth. That's its reward for flying down. And then that adult walks away and leaves the baby just sitting there. And the baby realises then, hey, I'm out of the tree, I'm down on the ground, and I've just been left alone. So it starts squawking, 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 again, again, again. Half an hour can go by and it squawks and squawks and squawks. And meanwhile, the other magpies are in the vicinity saying, come on, walk over here. You don't have to fly this time, just walk. It looks around and it can see that there are numbers of magpies around, and eventually it may walk over to where one of the others magpies is feeding. And again, as soon as it walks there, they'll put some food in its mouth. And then that adult magpie walks away and leaves the baby again. Only this time the adults fly up to a tree. And the magpie baby sees that it's not only alone on the ground, but everyone's gone. And it starts squawking again. Squawk, squawk, squawk. And then the adults in the tree say, come on, fly up here. I can't, it's too far. Just over here. No, no, not over there, it's too high. And this goes on for maybe 20 minutes before the bird finally takes up its courage and flies up to the tree. And as soon as it does, an adult comes in, gives it a piece of food. And that goes on again and again, repeated throughout the whole day, day after day, until that baby is ready to fly on its own. And all of that squawking is the baby's expression of fear and surprise. That, you mean I've got to fly all the way down there?
You mean I'm going to be on my own? I've got to fly all the way up there? All of that is expressed in that squawking. And although the baby is afraid, it has to overcome its fear. It has to be courageous if it's going to learn and if it's going to survive. This is very basic. This is survival. This is what magpies have to learn if they're going to live through the season, if they're going to make it to be adolescents, if they're going to make it to be adults. Now, in contrast to the magpies is another kind of bird which we have in the bush called a frogmouth owl. And you probably don't have these ones in your home gardens because these are very quiet birds, particularly compared to the magpies. But these birds are different also in that they nest as a pair. And the parent birds take turns equally to look after the baby while it's an egg, to incubate it, and once it's born, to sit with it, to sit on it, and to protect it from any of the other predator birds which come around. Because frogmouths build their nests on very exposed limbs of trees, and they're not very good nests. So one of the parent birds sits all day looking after that baby while the other parent bird flies out to find food and brings it back, and they take literally 12-hour shifts if you watch them. Sits there all day until time for change. The other parent bird comes, takes over, sits with the baby and stays with it through the whole of the next 12 hours while the other bird flies out, gets food, brings it back. Now, when this baby is ready to learn what it means to be a frogmouth owl, it has to learn quite a different set of behaviours to the magpies. Frogmouths survive through being very quiet, and they survive through being camouflaged. When they're sitting in a tree, their feathers are so much the colour of the tree that they're sitting on, the bark of the trees that they're sitting on, that you can hardly see the bird sitting there. And they perch in such a way that they look just like a branch. They sit with their heads, their necks extended and their heads gazing up, and because of the feathers, the shape of their feathers, they look just like a branch or a broken branch on the tree. And if you disturb them, you don't even know that they're there if you walk past them. Now, recently we were doing some work in the bush and we came across a baby frogmouth down on the ground with one of its parents, and as we approached, we were quite quiet, and we startled them, and the parent flew away. But the other parent was sitting on the tree right next to it, just watching. And the baby frogmouth sat on the ground, or sat on a log it was, perfectly still. It didn't have the reflexes of the adult bird, so it couldn't just fly away immediately as soon as it was startled. And it had to adopt the defence mechanism of the frogmouth. And that is to sit perfectly still, rely on the camouflage effect, and pretend you're not there, and hope that no one else knows you're there. Now, this baby still had its soft feathers. It was still not ready for this kind of test. And as it sat there on the log, and as we passed by it, it was shaking with fear. And yet its instinct to fly was overridden by its instinct to survive using what it had been taught and what it had been conditioned to do, that was to sit very still. And it took a lot of courage for that bird not to just squawk and try to get away. What was interesting too was to reflect on not only how it had to trust what it had been taught, but that even doing that, there was no guarantee that it wouldn't be harmed, because even doing what was the correct thing for a frog mouth to do, we could have been careless or deliberately harmed it. Now, to contrast the two reactions of the birds, we can see conditioning at play. The magpies live in a group, and they're used to being very noisy and letting everything out when something happens. They share it with each other whenever anything happens. If you notice magpies, if they're as a group, whenever they're feeding, there's always one bird that's on guard to make sure that nothing happens. And they'll always squawk a warning if anything or anyone comes near. And whatever they do, they tell each other all the time, "Here's some food. I'm going over there. Why don't you come too? Oh, there's some water. Let's go and get a drink. Isn't this nice water?" They're all the time talking to each other. This is their conditioning. And so in a fear situation, their reaction is to let everyone know that they're afraid and to hope that somehow someone will come to their rescue. Somehow just sharing it around makes them feel better. Now, the frog mouth, by contrast, is the nuclear family, just the two, mum and dad and the kids. And everything depends on those very close relationships. And when something happens, you better know what to do yourself, because you've got to rely just on yourself. Maybe mum and dad are there, but they can't get you out of this fix. And so the frog mouth learns to be quiet, learns to shut up, keep it in, and hope that it will go away, whatever it is that's fear-provoking. Now, as I watch the birds, I contemplated how so like us these birds are in their reactions to fear. Some of us have grown up in families where everyone knows everyone's business. And I've even heard people saying that when they've grown up in a big family, even if they live in different countries, they're always on the telephone to each other. As soon as something happens, it goes down the line. Everyone knows very soon. And if someone's ringing their mother, for example, and the mother's phone is engaged, what they do is they ring round to all the aunties to see who else has got their phone engaged. And then they put two and two together, and it must be mother and auntie on the phone. And so they ring cousin and say, "Go over and tell your mother to get off the phone, because I want to ring my mother and tell her something." And this is what happens, because people are used to sharing everything. And whenever anything good or bad happens, whenever fear arises, this kind of conditioning, it's likely that we will let other people know that we're having a bad time, that something is challenging us, that this is something which we need a bit of help with if we're going to deal with it. Some of us have grown up in families where you don't let out your fears, where you don't pass on the information, where you've basically got to learn to look after yourself. And so difficulties arise, challenges come, problems, and we bottle it up and we keep it to ourselves. We try to get over it on our own, or we hope that it will go away if we just don't acknowledge it. Now, these are generalizations, but I'm sure you can see yourself somewhere in there with this reaction to fear. Now, the birds have to overcome their fear of flying, which is so basic to their existence, in order to survive. They've got very few options otherwise. But for human beings, because we are very clever at manipulating the environment, very clever at manipulating conditions, sometimes we think that we are clever enough to manipulate away any of the problems that we might have to encounter in life. We might try to overcome our fears by making our world as safe and as much the way we want it to be, as much under our control as possible. And to a certain extent, we can do that. We're clever enough, for example, to manipulate the environment. When it's too hot, we can put on the air conditioner. When it's too cold, we can put on the heater. We think we can overcome, get rid of hot and cold. But we create different challenges then. What happens is so many people switch on their air conditioner, there's not enough electricity to support all that cooling. We create new problems through our solutions. And so again, if we are thinking about trying to make our world safe, perfect, and free of fear, if we contemplate it long enough, we'll see that that's impossible. We'll see that eventually we're going to have to face conditions which we don't like, conditions which aren't under our control, conditions which challenge us. We're going to have to face our fears. We're going to have to face our fears in order to survive. Sometimes we see that because we can manipulate our life to a large extent, that we actually are boxed in by our fears, trying to maintain a level of comfort at all costs. We see this, for example, when people live in very comfortable houses surrounded by barbed wire so that anything bad stays away. And then they become too afraid to come out from behind their high walls. But we can notice this in small ways too, even when we practice the Dharma. I very often hear people say, I'd love to do a retreat, a weekend retreat. I don't think I could manage any longer than that, because I couldn't stand being away from home, from my own bed, from my own kitchen, from my own bathroom, from my own this, from my own that. I don't think I could stand the discomfort of sitting in meditation. My legs would ache too much, my back would ache too much. Or I don't think I could stand watching my mind for a whole day, for a whole weekend. And then I hear people say, well, I'm ready for a weekend retreat, but I'm not ready for a 10-day retreat. A 10-day retreat is just too much. And why is that? Because it takes us out of our comfort zone. It brings up the fear that we're going to be discomforted, that we're going to have to be without the things that we depend on for security, that we depend on to be in control of our life. So in large ways and in small ways, we can see that fear of discomfort, fear of being out of control, boxes us in, even when we're waking up to its presence in our life. And depending on our conditioning, we might know fear, no challenges, and squawk about them as a way of avoiding them, of overcoming them, of getting round them. Or we might hold them in, hope that they'll go away, hope that we'll be able to avoid them for as long as possible. But either of these ways, if they don't eventually lead us to confronting our fears, aren't going to take us to freedom. So the first aspect of challenging our fears is to acknowledge that we have them, to see how they limit what we do in our life because of the worry, what if. And the next thing is to acknowledge that no matter how clever we are, that there are always going to be things which happen out of our control. That it's not possible to abolish all the things that could lead to our discomfort in this life. And to recognize that the only way that we're going to maximize the potentials that we have in this life is to move out and address the fears that we have. And this is courage. Courage is the willingness to deal with what needs to be dealt with, even when fear is present. Those birds had to have courage to face their fears. So acknowledging our fears means using mindfulness to pay attention to our reactions when we come up against something that takes us out of our comfort zone. How do we discover what our comfort zone is? Well, we listen with mindfulness to all of those inner conversations about why we can't do this, why we can't go there, why, etc., etc., etc. We start to wake up to the self-limiting nature of the fears that we have. With mindfulness, we pay attention to the stories that we tell ourselves, to the internal dialogue that explains things away. And we also pay attention to the feelings that arise in the body, because fear though it's a very strong or can be a very strong emotion, can also be very subtle, especially if we're trying to ignore it, if we're trying not to see it, then we may not see past our usual explanations for our limitations. But if we pay attention to what's going on physically in the body, very often we'll feel the tightening in the chest, the clenching of the teeth, the churning of the stomach, the pulsing heat that comes when fear is present. This is a very interesting experiment to do. Investigate what really is going on in the body when we say we can't do this or we can't do that. When we approach those things in our life which we know we resist, especially when it has to do with change. We might discover that behind our justifications, behind our resistances, surprise, surprise, there's fear. When we reflect on the birds, the magpies, and the frogmouth, and we see how they respond to the stresses of change, of growing up, of learning, we see the different reactions that they have. We don't judge either reaction as being better or worse than the other. Neither one of them is right or wrong. They're just the way they are. They're just the result of conditioning. And so when we investigate our own experience and notice when fear is present, we simply notice it in the same non-judgmental way as we do with the birds. What this practice path is about is discovering ourselves, discovering our life, discovering what our experience of life really is. So when we pay attention and we notice fear is present, that's wonderful. That's what we're trying to do, to be fully in touch with our experience in the present moment. We're not condemning. We're not saying, ah, I knew it. Found you at last, caught you out. I know what's really going on. It's not that kind of attitude. It's great to wake up, because once we know what our experience actually is, then we can investigate it further to see whether or not it's useful, whether or not it's helpful. Now, it's interesting to reflect that fear has its place. It serves a positive purpose. Fear arises to warn us of danger, in response to danger, to protect us. Fear is also very helpful in preventing us from doing things which we're later going to regret having done. So particularly when we have fear of the consequences and fear of people's reactions to what we're going to do, this can often prevent us from doing something which is unskillful, unwholesome. In fact, the Buddha described fear of people's reactions when we do something which is hurtful or unskillful, as a guardian, as a protector of the world. So fear has a place. And apart from protecting us from making bad karma, it also warns us when danger is present. So when we are paying attention and waking up to the fact that fear is present in a non-judgmental way, we may see that it's good that fear is present at this moment to protect me, to warn me. The problem becomes, or it becomes a problem, when fear outlasts its use as a danger signal, and when fear becomes our constant companion. This is when it becomes counterproductive. This is when it becomes limiting in the way that we live our life. So, first of all, acknowledging its presence, and then discerning whether or not this is one of those occasions when it's useful, or when it's one of those occasions when it's not useful. And to acknowledge fear sometimes can just be enough to remove it. We know it's there, but we still have to act. Having seen it directly, it doesn't override us, it doesn't drive us. If fear is present and we still have to act, or if fear is present and it determines what we do in a particular situation, then what we apply is mindfulness to see how does this affect my life when fear is present. Does it automatically determine the decision I'm going to make? Does it already limit my options? Does it push me in the direction I don't want to go? This is the investigative quality of mindfulness called clear comprehension, to know the purpose of our actions and the results of those actions. So investigating at the moment when fear is present, what does it do in my life? And if we see that it's counterproductive to our happiness, if it limits us in our options, if it prevents us from pursuing what we really want to pursue, then we need to challenge it. And we do this little by little. So, for example, if we're not ready for a 10-day retreat, then we take up the challenge of a weekend retreat. If we're not ready for a weekend retreat, then we take up the challenge of meditating regularly and coming to the centre and regularly meditating no matter what every weekend when there are classes, when there are group sittings, when there's the opportunity to be supported in our meditation practice. Unless we start to challenge our fears, we're never going to be able to tackle them and overcome them. And we're going to find that we're constantly pushed around by them, very often in subtle ways, which we don't realise are happening until it's too late. So if we are still thinking that one day we're going to get our meditation together, one day we're going to get it all ready so that we'll be able to go and do that retreat that we'd like to do, that we've heard about, we have to start now to prepare for that, or that one day will never come. because fear is unpleasant, because it produces strong emotions, because it's something often that connects us with fear we've had in other places at other times, it's a very good working ground, practice ground for waking up, for developing this mindfulness which listens on the spot to what we're telling ourselves about the situation we're in, and which pays attention to the experience in the body that is produced in the present moment. In a non-judgmental way, with curiosity, investigating to see what is the experience when fear is present, and what does it produce in my thought, speech, and action. For the birds, their survival depends on overcoming their fear of flying. They have little choice. As human beings with the human mind, we're so tricky and clever that we can circumvent a lot of our fear. We can think up ways of overcoming it without actually directly addressing it. But eventually, we'll get caught, because eventually all of us will face the death of this body. And that is a time for many people when fear arises very strongly. And if we haven't practiced dealing with fear throughout our life, and we haven't faced up to the reality of life being out of our control, then the fear that we face at the time of death may be very strong. So, for our own well-being throughout this life, and also when we come to the end of this life, it's very important that we take a good look at fear, become familiar with it in our own life, and learn to accept the challenge that it presents, so that we can live to our full potential, both in worldly ways, but also in cultivating the path of Dharma. So may this teaching be of benefit to all of us as we try to become fearless in this life, and may the merit of this teaching help us all to attain Nibbana. Does anyone have any questions or comments? The question is, could we say that fear is the ultimate emotion that we're guided by? And that's a very good point. And yes, if we look at where fear arises or why fear arises, we'll see that it always comes back to self-preservation. It comes back to the fear of something happening to me, to a sense of self. From the smallest thing to the largest, the fear of not getting what we want, the fear of having to put up with something that we don't like, is all because of trying to preserve me in the most comfortable way. and the ultimate fear is the fear of death. And this is why fear is an emotion that needs to be addressed, because it's so much an expression of self-grasping, self-cherishing, and it is when it's present, it is fertile ground for any of the defilements, greed, hatred and delusion, to arise. So to look after ourselves, to protect ourselves, we hurt other people, we hurt other beings. When that fear of something is going to hurt me, we'll get rid of it, that kind of reaction. So when fear is present, it gives rise to all kinds of unskillful states of mind and unskillful speech and behaviour. So it's the ultimate emotion, yes. And that's why it needs to be addressed, because it does give rise to so much unskillfulness. So when we think about the birds, that's a light-hearted way of entering into a contemplation of where fear comes from and how it drives us in our life. So we can see in the culture that we live in that there's a tremendous fear of ageing, a fear of this body changing, becoming less beautiful, becoming less energetic. And it seems like it's a wonderful thing, the beauty industry and all the cosmetics and all the ways that we can delay the aging process. But behind it is the fear. I'm losing something by becoming older. I'm losing something by becoming older looking, by the body becoming slower. So there's a fear behind what even seems to be a wonderful advantage in today's world. Elaborate on fear of dying. Well, that's the ultimate test, I suppose, because the fear of dying, again, arises out of this delusion that, first of all, this death is the end of me, and there's a resistance to that. It's the ultimate end of me. That is, again, wrong understanding, because death is the end of the body that we've been inhabiting, or that the mind has been inhabiting during this life. But death is the falling away of the body, but the mind that's unenlightened will seek a place somewhere else, seek another nesting place, and according to the quality of the mind at the end of the life, it will be reborn according to its karma in the same realm, the human realm, or in the higher realms, in the heavenly realms, or in the lower realms, in the animal realms or ghostly realms, depending on the state of mind at the time of death. And so if fear is present at the time of death, this can be a very unwholesome state of mind, fear and resistance to the fact that one is about to die, particularly if one has lived unskillfully. One can not be sure that rebirth isn't a fact, and you might have rejected the idea throughout your life, but at the time of death, well, you can't be really sure, and so fear arises. So it can be the fear of that arises from ignorance, just thinking that life is going to end and you don't want it to, or fear that comes from the sneaking suspicion that it may not end and you've got to be reborn somewhere else, and being worried about that. And with either of those states present, then the mind is very distressed and disturbed, and it's not conducive to attaining a favourable rebirth. So in this life itself, we can prepare for facing our death by facing our fears. And if we face them again and again and again, we will have the understanding that ultimately there's only so much we can do. Very often, learning to accept a situation and deal with it removes so much of our resistance, which is fear. And if we do that again and again and again at the time of death, we may be able to accept, well, there's nothing I can do to stop it. Let me just accept it and be at peace. If this is the end of this life, okay, it's the end. If there's rebirth, okay, let's rebirth happen. Whatever it is, I'm accepting and I'm at peace. I've done what I can do and that's it. So if we practice throughout this life to keep addressing fears as we become aware of them, we can become much more accepting, understanding what we can do something with, and understanding what we have to just allow to let take its course and be at peace with it. Right, so the question is about fear and love being the two basic emotions, and that our ability to love is only limited by our fears. And that's very true. If you think about what we mean by love, the ordinary understanding of love always has with it the connotation of grasping an ownership of the object that we love, and that when we have this sense of owning, grasping after the object, then there's always the fear that that object is going to be lost. Either the object's going to change, or that it's going to go away, that it's no longer going to be ours anymore. And so when we have that sense of ownership of the object that we love, then fear is always present, because change is a part of life. When we realise that, then we know that even our love object is subject to change. If you contrast that with the understanding of loving kindness, or metta in Buddhist practice, that kind of love is without grasping. It's not conditional on the object being lovable. It's love which is given because the person who's giving the love has love in their heart, and the object may not be a lovable object, may not be something which we like, but the love that comes from the heart is given because it's there, because the love is there. And there isn't a sense of having to own the object in order to feel that it's worth being loved. And because there's no sense of ownership, and because the love is given unconditionally, not expecting anything in return, there's no fear. The love that's bound up with fear is always on the condition of getting back what we want from the love object. And so there's always the fear that that's not going to happen. So, yes, our ability to love and to give unconditionally is also bound up with our fear is contrasted with that love which is bound up with fear, which is always the fear of losing the object of our love. But when we understand that there will always be situations in our life that we can't control, that there are certain things that are always going to be possibilities of things not being the way we want them to be, that we can't have perfection, and we can't have it for long, then that realisation itself removes so much fear, because we understand that we're going to have to face difficulties and challenges. We can't avoid it, so rather than trying to live in fairyland, where everything is perfect, we come down to earth and learn to deal with things as they arise. So I think it's probably enough now. Sāmi Supatipanno Bhagavato